The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily radio show, already our last show of the week. It's hard to believe how fast the time goes. We're coming up, actually, on our one-year anniversary of KPCG programming. That's just a little less than a month away, as we've been going at it now for nearly a year. And these weeks, it seems, they just go by a little bit faster each week. If you'd like to email the show, send those comments, send that feedback to td@kpcg.fm. And remember, as I asked yesterday, those of you that are listening or new listeners that have just joined the listening audience for the last week or two, we'd love to hear from you. We'd love to hear how you came across the program. What was it that held you back, maybe not knowing about it, or perhaps it was a technology upgrade that you needed first. In any event, let us know. Let us know about your background and your listening habits. We'd love to hear from you. It's Friday, as I said, so keep in mind that later today, Trumpet Hour comes on. That's 4 p.m. Oklahoma time. Friday means the Trumpet Hour roundtable. And as always, there's lots and lots to discuss, lots and lots to cover on that program. So we'll look forward to that later today. Well, speaking of Trumpet Hour, if you didn't hear Wednesday's broadcast on that particular show, Joel Hilliker interviewed Andrew Locher, the CFO of the college, Herbert W. Armstrong College. And Andrew Locher has a special interest in all things military. On that segment, he was talking about Mr. Hilliker set it up by just talking about the huge amount of money that the United States spends on military. And yet, as was brought out in that segment, and Andrew Locher alluded to this, a lot of that money is being spent in vain. It just seems like there's one bad thing after another. He talked about the billion-dollar submarine program, how that three of America's newest submarines are currently dry docked because of seemingly small problems, but these are setbacks that just continue to happen. Richard Palmer's been on the program recently, Trumpet Hour, that is, talking about all of the problems associated with the new F-35s, those aircraft that are proving to be so vulnerable now. Brand new, state-of-the-art. Of course, they're running behind schedule and costs are escalating, but here it's so vulnerable, these new technologies, because they're so dependent on technology, so reliant. And even Andrew Locher brought this out in the program Wednesday. Joe Hilliker mentioned that verse in Leviticus 26, where it says that America's strength would be spent in vain. We've talked about this prophecy many times over the years from Leviticus 26. That whole chapter really is a pivotal prophecy, one of the most important, perhaps the most important prophecy in the Old Testament. And it talks about our strength being spent in vain. And so it's not saying that the United States wouldn't have strength in the latter days. There would be strength. Plenty of it, but that it would be spent in vain. And if you look at the verse just before that one in Leviticus 26, it talks about the pride of America's power being broken. Being broken. We don't have the necessary will to follow through and to actually face an enemy and to crush an enemy. That will just isn't there. We talked about this back in 2008. This was actually before President Obama came into office, and we set up the article by saying, if America chooses the anti-war candidate, that being Barack Obama, these are some of the things that are going to be happening. We wrote in 08, thousands of years ago, God said we would have awesome power in this end time, but without an ironclad will to go with it. Furthermore, he prophesied that we would even flex our military muscle by using our vast array of firepower, but that impressive show of strength would eventually be spent in vain. However the details play out, God's word will be proven true. And so everywhere that America has gone in recent decades and flexed its military might, you look later, sometimes not even that long or that much later, and see how that strength was spent in vain. $1.7 trillion, I think it was, spent on the war in Iraq. And what does the United States have to show for it? What does the United States have to show for running Mubarak out of town in Egypt? What does the United States have to show for turning Libya upside down? This took strength, but was it spent in vain? And then look at the world as it just descends into this chaos. It's interesting to me just to see how many. President Obama's not even out of office yet. He still has a little less than a year to go. But it's amazing to me to see just how many prominent Democrats, Democratic voices, are coming out talking about just the disastrous foreign policy for the United States these past 7 years. This first comment here is a statement made by President Bill Clinton just yesterday. This is clip 5.
And keep in mind, unlike when I became president, a lot of things are coming apart around the world now. We'd like to just think about our economic issues, but you got to worry about a collapse in Europe dragging back the American economy. You've got to worry about all these, the largest number of refugees since World War II. And all this stuff comes home.
He says, things are coming apart around the world now. Unlike when I was president, back in the 1990s, that's a not so subtle swipe there at President Obama's handling of world affairs. A fellow Democrat. That's U.S., again, former U.S. President Bill Clinton. Fellow Democrats. That's not the only statement he's made in recent weeks that talks about the failures of this current administration. The California governor, Jerry Brown. Well, before I play this clip, President Obama, if you remember, had that nuclear weapons summit there at the White House with leaders from the P5 plus one. We played some segments or clips from that just the other day. But this is Governor Jerry Brown, and I mean, you can't get much further to the left than Jerry Brown, the Democrat from California. And this is what he had to say in response to that White House nuclear security summit. This is clip 4.
But just take this matter of a terrorist nuclear bomb in Washington. If you could blow up half the Congress and kill the president and the vice president, what happens to America? Is there an America left as we have known it since the founding of the Republic? Probably not. So is that a risk? 1 in 100? 1 in 1,000? Whatever it is, that risk is too high not to do every single thing possible to avert it. Are we doing everything possible to avert it? No. We're engaged in a lot of other activities that are blocking the focus on this existential threat that we know, at least if we believe Bill Perry, this is real. And yet, if you look through your paper today, you're not going to see it's too real. Now, there is a summit. That's good. But that doesn't mean they even have a plan to deal with all the nuclear material that is loose in the world, because they don't.
They don't even have a plan, he says, about the Obama administration. They don't even have a plan about all of the nuclear material that's just loose in the world. They might say they have a plan, but they don't. That's Governor Jerry Brown's assessment, not Ted Cruz, not Donald Trump, not someone from the conservative wing. I mean, these are warnings, these are criticisms coming from hard left Democrats who are beginning to see just how dangerous and how chaotic this world really and truly is right now. Now, you can add to that prophecy Mr. Hilliker referred to on Wednesday, the pride of our power, the strength being spent in vain, another one that factors in prominently to what we see happening right now in the world today, and in particular in the United States, is the prophecy in Isaiah 3, where it talks about the dearth of leadership. God's talking about a total disaster in those first few verses of Isaiah 3. And verse 2 says, the mighty man's taken away, the man of war, the judge, the prophet, the prudent, the captains, the ancient, the honorable men, the counselors, the great speakers. God has taken them away. God has removed them from our society. And verse 4 says, this is Isaiah 3, and I'll give children to be their princes, and babes will rule over them. Not actual children, as we've said so often, but adults with the mentality of children. Young, inexperienced adults who think they know everything but don't know anything. And that's why we see so many childish decisions, even at the top levels of government. That's why we see so much childish behavior out on the campaign trail. It's easy to criticize, and some commentators have. But how many see that this is a curse from God, God taking away the leaders? And how much longer can America survive without strong leadership? How much longer can America survive in the face of such strong opposition coming from so many tyrants and dictators? Well, I'm talking about from abroad. We're struggling with some of those same things at home as well. As Andrew Miller brought out on that same program Wednesday, the Trumpet Hour. Fox News recently had a report, just following on what Andrew Locher got into on Wednesday, but they recently had a report on the rising threats in the world, even as the U.S. military shrinks. And what was so shocking about this report is that here they were interviewing all of these former defense secretaries from President Obama's administration, not from George Bush, not from Bill Clinton, or not from President Bush the senior, not from the Reagan administration. These are three defense secretaries from President Obama's administration the past 7 years. And as that Fox report brought out, all of them shared in this one particular criticism of the current administration in the White House. And that is that you have a young, very inexperienced White House staff that's pretty much running international affairs for the United States, that's pretty much running international conflicts. Wars, in other words. And these are 30-somethings with their PhDs, smart individuals academically, but not so bright when it comes to all the things listed there in Isaiah 3. The prudent, the wise, the counselors. This first clip here, I'll just play the three statements. It's actually Fox News kind of piecing together statements. You'll hear the edits as it plays through. But these are three statements coming from three defense secretaries. This first one here from the former defense secretary, Robert Gates, and this, as I say, is from that Fox News interview on rising threats, shrinking military.
It was the operational micromanagement that drove me nuts, of White House and NSC staffers calling senior commanders out in the field and asking them questions, of second-guessing commanders. When I was Deputy National Security Advisor, if I would have tried to, even as deputy, if I had tried to call a field commander going around Dick Cheney, who was Secretary of Defense, or Colin Powell, who was Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, I'd have had my head handed to me, probably personally by the president. I told the combatant commanders and others, and the field commanders, Petraeus and others, if you get calls from the White House staff, you know, you get a call from the president, that's one thing. That's totally okay. That's the chain of command. But you get a call from some White House or National Security Council staffer, you tell them to call me instead.
Here's a case where, in the view of Robert Gates, you have these young White House staffers calling commanders out in the field. He went on in that exchange, by the way, to talk about just how, as he said, how President Obama was deeply suspicious of U.S. military actions, of U.S. military recommendations, particularly in Afghanistan. And Gates said, I pleaded with the president, look, they're doing their best. They want to support you. They're not going around you. They're not trying to undermine your positions or your decisions. But here is a president, the president of the United States, who's deeply suspicious of the military and all of these young staffers who are behind it, who are bending the president's ear. That was Robert Gates. Here's what former Defense Secretary Leon Panetta had to say.
The National Security Council has grown enormously, which means you have a lot more staff people running around at the White House on these foreign policy issues. And very frankly, proximity is everything when you're operating at the White House. The person that's closest to the president has greater influence than even a cabinet member who may be located elsewhere in a department. Staff people try to read what is it that the president wants and then try through the back door influence the direction of policy. What that does is it undermines the very process that a president needs in order to get the best discussion and information possible to be able to make the right decisions. Too often, people are kind of worried or second-guessing where the president wants to go, and they try to then shape their views to basically please the president. I think, you know, what I've seen in these last 4 years is almost this cautiousness and overcorrection, which makes it appear that the United States is hesitant to take action. And that sends, I think, a message of weakness.
That's the message. That's the message the United States was sending, according to Leon Panetta. A message of weakness, of indecision. And a lot of that being driven by this ever-growing bureaucracy, this large staff of young people, all of these White House staffers that were getting in there and meddling in national security affairs. This final one here, this comes from again, a former defense secretary, Chuck Hagel, and here's what he had to say.
On President Obama, he's one of the youngest presidents we've ever had, one of the most inexperienced presidents we've ever had. He has a staff around him that is very inexperienced. I don't think there's one veteran on his senior staff at the White House. I don't believe there's one business person. I don't believe there's one person who's ever run anything. Other than Vice President Biden, none of them have ever been elected to anything. You must leaven the loaf. You must leaven your advisors where you get a lot of experience in different things where he, the president himself, is so inexperienced. I think he's got to fundamentally understand, and I'm not sure he ever did, nor the people around him, the tremendous responsibility the United States has. Not to be the world's policeman, but to lead, and we're the only ones who can. And the world becomes more dangerous, not less dangerous, when America gets less involved in the world. I don't mean invading and occupying and imposing, but leading, engaging. Ambassador Rice would often start with, this is what the president wants. Well, I've never thought that that's the way a national security advisor should start a meeting with the National Security Council, because that sets right away an immediate expectation. This is what he wants. And there were always too many meetings and always too many people in the room and too many people talking. And, you know, especially young, smart, 35-year-old PhDs love to talk, because that's the way you let everybody know how smart you are, is how much you talk. So there were a lot of reasons those meetings kind of descended into kind of nonsense and the hard time we had to making a decision as a result of that.
Now, these three interviews, they don't exactly speak well of the administration and how things operate inside the White House. That's that last one there, that's basically him saying there's no leadership. There's no qualified, experienced leadership. There's no veterans. There's not even a businessman. They're not even elected into office. They're all young and inexperienced, including the president himself. Well, maybe he's not so young anymore. But he came into office 7.5 years ago, and certainly one of the younger presidents the United States has had, and very inexperienced. And yet all of these young and inexperienced leaders, they have a definite worldview. There certainly is an agenda. And look at the way it's changing the world. Is it making the world a safer place? They would tell you yes. Even as we see one explosion after another explosion after another, you take the Middle East as the most obvious example. Let me just play for you another clip. This is actually from a series that ran over here in the UK. It's from the BBC Two, a series entitled Inside Obama's White House. And so it's basically, again, just like those three defense secretaries brought out, giving us some insight into the way the government works there at the executive branch. This is what the BBC Two series brings out as well. And this clip I'm about to play for you, it's about the popular uprising in Egypt. You remember the early stages of the Arab Spring back in 2011 and how the U.S. responded. And in this particular clip, it again, there's a bit from the narrator at the end, but it again relies upon some statements made by the former defense secretary, Robert Gates.
I actually lived next door to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And once he knew I was home, he asked to come over and talk with me. And he told me that there was a strong move at the White House to tell Mubarak he had to get out. I thought it was a crazy idea.
Obama went for the crazy idea.
Gates thought it was a crazy idea, this strong move coming from inside the White House to boot Mubarak to not stand up to a U.S. ally, to abandon a U.S. ally. He was against it. The Defense Department against it. But not the young, inexperienced leaders inside the White House. Not them. They wanted Mubarak out. And this this documentary, it goes back and just covers some of the details that I had even forgotten a few of them myself, how that the White House tried to handle it discreetly there, telling Mubarak or one of his aides that he needed to step down. They did it privately. And then if you remember this, Mubarak came and had a press conference, and it sounded like that's the direction that he was going. And then right at the end of the press conference, he said, "I'm staying. I'm staying. This is my nation." And he was telling the United States himself in return that, look, you don't know Egypt the way I do. You push me aside and the Muslim Brotherhood's going to fill the vacuum. You push me aside and this whole region's going to become more dangerous. You don't know this region the way I do. That's what he said. Who was right? Well, he wouldn't step down after the White House applied pressure discreetly. And so what happened thereafter? Well, President Obama came out in a very public fashion, insisting that Mubarak step down. And people around the world, especially in the Middle East, were shocked at the United States leaving Mubarak high and dry, basically siding with the popular uprising. Listen to this. This is from that same BBC Two series, Inside Obama's White House, as it recounts some of the history that happened there with that decision to push him out, and then what happened soon after. Oh, okay. I thought we had clip 7. You don't have? No? Oh, I didn't. I must not have emailed that to Sam earlier. So that's my bad. In any event, well, I can summarize it for you. Maybe I'll try to pull that clip later and play it for you Monday. But it had a White House staffer on there basically saying, you know, once Obama stepped down, or sorry, Mubarak stepped down, they turned on Al Jazeera, and that this was a great day. And then he's actually quoted as saying a lot of bad days came after. I mean, this was a great day when Mubarak stepped down. Now, it is true, a lot of bad days came later, but at least there was one good day. And then the program says, Egypt will never be the same. That's what the White House staffers were saying. That's what President Obama came out and said. He got up and basked in the glory of the White House pushing him out of town, pushing him out of office. And he said, this is an incredible moment in world history. This is a wonderful moment for Egypt. And then it quotes some prominent voices from that region who took note that America is no longer going to protect those leaders, those allies. It used Libya as an example to follow right after that, and how in this case the United States took much more aggressive action to topple the Gaddafi regime. And here again, you go down all of the dominoes that have fallen, and you look at the Middle East today. I didn't quite get to see the end of that series. I want to watch it this weekend. It'll be interesting to see just how the BBC covers all of this in hindsight. I mean, there is an acknowledgement there that the Arab Spring didn't turn out the way the White House had hoped. But is there any repentance? Has there been any change in course? Have the younger, inexperienced leaders awakened to the fact that this world is getting more dangerous? And the fact that perhaps we have to shore up our defenses, build up our defenses, and prepare in case something tragic happens, a great tragedy, like Jerry Brown discussed in that clip from last week. It's the same worldview. And they press forward, assuring the American people that, well, the world does get a little messy here and there, but in fact, the world's safer than it was 30 years ago. In fact, we're making progress. Now, you compare all of this that's happening, as I say, that was discussed on Trumpet Hour Wednesday. You compare this with what's happening in Europe right now. And you talk about a shocking role reversal. Comparing what Europe used to do, how Europe used to operate, how Europe used to think on terms of defense and war and violence and struggle, with what it's thinking now, given the crises. And then take that and contrast it with the way the United States approaches foreign policy, the way the United States approaches conflict. This is from a New York Times piece, April 2nd. A transatlantic role reversal. It says Americans are from Mars and Europeans are from Venus. With one pithy line 14 years ago, the foreign policy theorist Robert Kagan captured what seemed like obvious differences between the United States and Europe in the post-Cold War, post-9/11 age. It says most Europeans, Kagan argued, thought of themselves as citizens of a post-historical paradise of peace and relative prosperity in which threats could be safely managed without military force. And systems of transnational negotiation and cooperation were making war and nationalism obsolete. Even if, as he conceded, the Mars and Venus language oversimplified things, anyone who observed Western politics in that era could see the pattern he was talking about, the assumptions that separated the American perspective from the worldview of Brussels, Paris, and Berlin. I mean, he's talking about a dramatic transformation that's happened just in the last 8-10 years in Europe on the one hand and in the United States on the other. It's too soon to say Europeans are actually from Mars once again, but the continent's Venusian ideal has taken blow after blow, the Euro crisis, the aggressions of Vladimir Putin, and now the convergence of mass migration and Islamist terror. Nationalism is returning. Border fences are going up. The center is weakening. The far right is gaining power. The Mediterranean and the Russian marches are zones of conflict again. And ancient habits, French military adventurism, Little Englander separatism, a tense relationship with Islam are resurfacing. We're seeing some of the same problems that were there in the lead up to World War I, World War II. Says the European elite still believes in the Kantian dream of perpetual peace, which is how the continent ended up with Angela Merkel's open-door policy for Syrian refugees. But its leaders are also adopting a post-Kantian reality, and nowhere more so than in France, where the government has basically gone Le Bush-Cheney under both Nicolas Sarkozy and François Hollande, intervening in Libya, Mali, and Syria, responding to terrorist attacks with Bush-esque rhetoric and implementing a terror crackdown that makes the Patriot Act look like libertarian. So what is the significance of these massive shifts taking place in Europe and the United States? Meanwhile, the United States slipping back into this, well, we're in a post-historical paradise, and we can safely manage the threats of this world without military force. We can withdraw. We can pressure individuals to step down. And, I mean, it may get a little messy after Mubarak steps down, but, boy, that was a great day. That sure was a great day. When we, the White House staffers, when we pressured Mubarak to get out of town, what a blessing this was for the people of Egypt. What an opportunity this was for democracy. Well, they said much the same thing when Gaddafi was murdered. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, she laughed about it. This is wonderful. We came in here and he died, and let's move on. And so many others have since died. And you have this, these atrocities all over the region. This piece from the New York Times, this is by Ross Futha, I guess is how you pronounce his name if it's French. He says here, in certain ways, America is mirroring these trends. We're involved in Libya and Syria as well. We have our own refugee-related anxieties. Donald Trump, we have our own version of Europe's nationalist right. But if nationalism is making Europeans more militaristic, in America, it's inclining us to lay down the burdens of empire. See, they're becoming more militaristic in Europe. But the United States is withdrawing. We're laying down the burdens of empire. We're scaling back. We're hollowing out the military. We're still building F-35s and submarines, but they're not working so well. And it's frustrating. He says that's the subtext of Trump's rhetoric. I mean, Trump's coming from the right. Trump's the conservative, the leading conservative. And on this point, he sounds a lot like Bernie Sanders. Making America great again involves crushing ISIS, yes. But otherwise, it seems to involve washing our hands of military commitments, ceding living space to Putin, letting Japan and South Korea go nuclear, calling NATO obsolete. And it's simply the text of Bernie Sanders' campaign. He's running explicitly as the candidate of Venus. And meanwhile, in Europe, boy, they're taking on more of a militaristic tone, that's for sure. Implementing a terror crackdown that makes the Patriot Act look libertarian. How about that? Is this significant, this kind of transformation? This kind of transatlantic role reversal? Are there any other significant prophecies that come to mind? When you think about the weakening power and position of the United States, the immature and inexperienced leadership, pulling back, withdrawing, ceding living space to Putin and others, even as Europe assumes a much more aggressive posture. And this is even before the Daniel Eight Man shows up. That New York Times piece draws attention to France, who's much more aggressive in the face of terror, and for obvious reasons. But there are rumblings in Germany. As we've been preparing you for, we've been telling you about this. The rise of all those fringe parties. Reuters, it had a piece just recently. Germany can take that smug look off its face. Reuters says if a Der Spiegel cover is any indication of the mood in Germany, then Europe's largest country is on the verge of an explosion. That's Reuters now. Meanwhile, the 30-somethings in the White House, they're telling Mubarak, you've got to leave. They're advising the president, let's pull back. Don't confront Putin. Forget about the red line. You let others take care of the problems in this world. And boy, that's happening. And meanwhile, Europe's largest country is on the verge of an explosion. Who else is telling you this? Who else is reporting on this? Who else even cares about this? Reuters says 2 weeks ago, the news magazine highlighted the country's growing income inequality in a cover story on the divided nation. The cover photo showed a couple in a gilded room with a dozen other people stooped in a claustrophobic cellar below them. Last week, the magazine featured the uprising of the Wutbürger, a new German term combining the words of rage and citizen. The citizens are enraged. They're coming up with new words to describe the people and how upset they are. The headline screams, "You guys up there are just lying to us all." You guys up there in government, that is. You guys surrounding Angela Merkel, that is. And then notice this. In the decades following World War II, West Germany built up its fabled social welfare system in part to compete with communist East Germany and in part to form a bulwark against the type of extremism that had given rise to Adolf Hitler. Consensus became a byword for the German way of doing politics. The conventions governing Germany's political interactions are changing with incredible speed, though. That's what Der Spiegel says. It's all happening so incredibly fast. It's on the verge of an explosion. This post-World War II period, this post-historical paradise, the vision of that so-called paradise has shattered in the minds of Europeans, in the minds of the people of France, in the minds of Germans. We referred to this piece just the other day from The Local about how that two-thirds of Germans want to end the open borders. They want to see Schengen discarded. They want to see borders erected. They want to see border security. They want to see an end to the migrant flow. They believe we've reached maximum capacity. In other words, reality is setting in for those on the continent, for those in the White House, not so much. There, it's still all about the fantasy. I like to take the long view, the president's fond of saying. We've got to be on the right side of history, he's fond of saying. It may get a little messy up front, but in the end, I mean, it's going to work out great. That's what they really believe. And so, hey, let's hollow out the military. And if we've got big problems with the F-35s and the nuclear submarines, it's not that big of a deal. I mean, we're still the United States of America. We still have the most powerful military in the world. And so nothing changes. And supposing someone like Bernie Sanders or Donald Trump gets into office, you think it's going to change for the better? Or is America to continue on this same trajectory? What a dramatic transformation. When you look at this role reversal, a transatlantic role reversal, the New York Times said. Brad McDonald last year, he talked about Europe waking to the threats. He talked about Europe coming out of this post-historical paradise. Yes, we were talking about this long before the New York Times came along. Brad McDonald said, being tolerant feels good until hundreds of thousands of foreigners enter your nation and expect you to foot the bill. Being multicultural is wonderful until Muslims waving Islamic State flags and eyeing your teenage daughters settle in your village. Being anti-war feels righteous until Russian tanks roll across the border. Europe right now is a place where dreams are beginning to meet reality. And so we ask, where is this leading? Where are we headed? If you're familiar with Herbert Armstrong, if you're familiar with the prophecies he talked about, the signature prophecy, and what will happen in Europe, and how all of this is building to the prophesied World War III. Mr. Armstrong explained so many times over the years how Germany was responsible for World War I, Germany was responsible for World War II, and then toward the end of World War II, when Germany realized it was going to lose, that's when their top generals, that's when their top scientists, that's when their top industrialists and bankers, that's when so many of them put in place plans for a third round, another round of world war. That's when so many of the Nazis went underground. Mr. Armstrong wrote back in the 60s, "We know how the United States of Europe will be used by Germany to attempt world domination. Prophecy shows 10 kings, 10 dictators will arise in Europe and give their power to Germany. That's what Bible prophecy shows." That was the signature prophecy of Herbert Armstrong and his 50-year ministry. Anyone who was familiar with his writings, anyone who heard him on radio or on television, anyone just instantly remembers what he said about Europe, about the 10 kings, about that church-state union. And if you followed us, following on Mr. Armstrong's work, if you followed us, you know all about the coming clash between the kings of the North and the kings of the South, or rather the king in each case, the king of the North, the king of the South. There's a head, there's a leader, but it represents several nations in both cases, a spectacular clash. And so that's why, in looking at this transatlantic role reversal, it's a stunning headline, really. Because how for so many years the United States is the one that was, as Chuck Hagel said, providing the leadership for the world. The United States, it wasn't that it was the policeman necessarily, as he said. It didn't have to go and get involved in every single war or conflict. But it did have to provide leadership. And as he was indicating there, a world without the U.S. at the lead is a much more dangerous place. And boy, it really sets the stage, doesn't it, for these prophecies to be fulfilled. This prophecy that Herbert Armstrong talked about from the very beginning of his ministry and continued with all the way through to his death in 1986. Let me just play for you a clip from Mr. Armstrong's old radio program as he's talking about the emergence of this beast power coming out of the heart of Europe.
Now, I've been telling our radio audience and readers of The Plain Truth that a political union of 10 nations in Europe would rise, resurrecting the Holy Roman Empire of the Middle Ages. I was predicting this even before World War II began. Not many believed it then. Well, let me quote to you what I wrote in an article in The Plain Truth of July 1935, 4 years before World War II was started by Adolf Hitler. I'll just quote a little out of the center of that entire article that shows what the article was saying and what it was talking about. Listen, quote, "Out of the present Italy is to emerge a reincarnation of the once great and powerful Roman Empire by an alliance of 10 nations within its territory." That was 4 years before World War II began. Biblical prophecy revealed that it would start as an economic movement that it would bring an era of unusual prosperity to Europe. It did start in March 1957, when six European countries, West Germany, France, Italy, Belgium, Holland, and Luxembourg, signed the Treaty of Rome, creating what was called the EEC, that is, the European Economic Community. It has been known, of course, as the European Common Market, and it came into being, actual operation, that is, on January the 1st, 1958. Immediately, it began to bring economic prosperity to those six countries and has provided economic competition for Britain, for the United States, and for other countries around the world. For years, European nations have wanted to unite in a sort of United States of Europe. What they want is political union, but they've never been able to bring that about. While President de Gaulle of France lived, Germany would never have yielded to accept him as a political head of a union, including Germany, and the French would not accept a German. Long-range plans are already underway for a common currency in Europe, but other things are going to intervene in the meantime that I want to tell you about, and I predict that there will be a common currency a great deal sooner in Europe. Now, how did I know, as far back as 1927 even, that this coming United States of Europe would spring up in our time? I knew because it's revealed in biblical prophecy.
How did he know, going as far back as 1927? That's almost 100 years ago. And here he's making those statements there, that clip I just played for you back in the probably the early 1960s. Long before a powerful 10-nation union would take shape in Europe. I mean, he made those statements right at the height of the Cold War, when half of Europe was controlled by communism, by the USSR. And yet he knew that that European Economic Community early on in the 1950s, that was the beginning stage of the final resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire. He knew there would eventually be a common currency. He knew it would eventually lead to a political union. He knew East and West Germany would reunite. He knew that Germany would dominate the Union of European Nations. And yes, he knew that the continent would take on a much more militaristic posture. He knew all these things. How did he know? Well, because he said there, or as he said there at the last, he knew because of biblical prophecy. He knew because of the sure word of Bible prophecy. What would he be saying today about the transatlantic role reversal? What would he be saying today about the New York Times talking about Europe coming out of that post-historical paradise and stepping into reality? Well, you can be sure he'd be crying aloud and sparing not, talking about this sure word of prophecy. It says in 2 Peter chapter 1, verse 20, knowing this first, that no prophecy of the Scripture is of any private interpretation. For the prophecy came not in old time by the will of man, but holy men of God spoke as they were moved by the Holy Spirit. These prophecies came direct from God through His holy men, and they are sure. As I said earlier, or asked, I mean, where else are you going to get this sure word of Bible prophecy? Except coming from God's work, coming through God's servant, coming from God's headquarters operation, coming from thetrumpet.com, coming from kpcg.fm. Well, there's a lot more that we could say. In fact, I had a whole second segment, and I'm not going to have time for segment two. Segment two will have to be on Monday. As we've continued on for the whole hour, or nearly an hour, with just this one segment, even with a few little glitches, and we got through it okay. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial. That's in Edmond, Oklahoma. That's right. A radio station that's almost a year old now. Coming up on our one-year anniversary in May. And since we started a year ago, we've connected that station to our campus, our beautiful campus here in Edstone, England, right in the heart of the UK. You can get the live stream at thetrumpet.com and at kpcg.fm. Hey, this weekend, particularly if you're a new listener, send us your emails, send us your feedback, send us your comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today. Thank you for joining us this week. We'll see you Monday.